Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's Ira Melman.
As Republicans encourage Americans to vote for President Donald Trump, they're making their case this week from Charlotte, North Carolina, where the pandemic has forced them to dramatically scale back their national convention. Even though the pandemic has shaken American businesses, there are many who say they still have faith in the president's ability to bring economic prosperity back. Isha Sarai has the story from Charlotte.
Throughout the coronavirus pandemic and his campaign for re-election, President Trump has focused his promises on reviving the economy while denouncing his Democratic rival Joe Biden's economic approach.
Biden the other day said, no, he'd shut it down. He'd listen to some guy say, and he'd shut it down. We just broke a record on jobs, an all-time record. There's never been 3 months where we've put more people to work, over 9 million people. And again, we're just about ready to break the all-time stock market record. I mean, you look at it, we're just about ready to do it again. And what that means is everything else is going to follow.
Delegates who formally nominated Trump as the Republican presidential candidate say they trust him to grow the American economy.
Before the pandemic hit, the economy was incredibly strong. You know, we had record unemployment. We had, you know, the stock market was making records every day. You know, across the board, the economy is really strong. And this pandemic is only temporary. You know, it's going to end eventually, and businesses are going to restart. So the question is, who has the experience to rebuild the economy?
He owns like 15 hotels.
Even delegates unable to attend the convention because of social distancing protocols say they don't blame the president for the current state of unemployment.
I don't think people are necessarily blaming the president more than just the shutdown and the nature of COVID.
But workers at hotels, restaurants, and cafes have been hit hardest by the pandemic, with the hospitality industry reporting that more than one quarter of workers in the industry are unemployed. That accounts for about one third of all job losses in the U.S. economy.
Well, I think the only way I personally feel that we can get the economy back is to shut down the pandemic. So we have to, I think, as a nation, decide that we have to do that first.
President Trump will continue to make his case to the American people as the convention continues virtually throughout the week. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
An independent report into Australia's Black Summer bushfires has recommended sweeping changes to land clearing practices and the creation of an international research center to investigate extreme fire behavior. The 2019-2020 disaster was unprecedented in scale. The Gospers Mountain fire north of Sydney was the largest forest fire ever recorded in Australia, burning more than 500,000 hectares. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
More aggressive hazard reduction or controlled burn-offs that can reduce the severity of future bushfires would make Australia safer, according to an independent panel. However, previous research has shown that as conditions get hotter and drier, it becomes less effective. But the report wants landowners in high-risk areas to increase prescribed burning. It also said that climate change was one of many factors that made last summer so extraordinary. The fires were fueled by record-breaking temperatures and a long drought across southern and eastern Australia. New South Wales State Premier Gladys Berejiklian says global warming is making the country more vulnerable.
The next fire season is already upon us. So the government has taken every action we can already in response to the recommendations that we received. We do have to also accept that in addition to the issues that have been canvassed this morning, our climate is changing. And those who wrote the report actually acknowledge that our climate is changing.
The New South Wales State Government has accepted each of the panel's 76 recommendations. The report has called for more scientific research into fighting fires, including the use of artificial intelligence and drones to help put them out quickly. It said the answer wasn't more fire trucks or firefighters. For VOA News, Phil Mercer, Sydney.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and I have more great stories from the past week to share when VOA Asia Weekend continues in just a moment.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Taiwan recently hosted its annual Automation, Intelligence, and Robot Show. The event was separated into five different product categories of smart manufacturing, smart services, service robots, artificial intelligence, and industrial supply, with the main focus on industrial robotic arms. Wang Xu, the divisional director for the Industrial Technology Research Institute, spoke on the local availability of the robotic arms.
There are many locally made industrial robotic arms available now. We're quite mature in this sector. Right now, the emphasis, and this is what our research institute is focusing on, is upgrading to a total system solution platform.
Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the demand for autonomous robotic arms has skyrocketed as more factories continue to look to replace human workers with robots. Wang Xu went on to explain the current state of the industry.
This kind of total systems integration can bring about an upgrade of our traditional industrial base. Taiwan's industrial base is still very much medium to small factories. The challenges of these factories are smaller volume output, but more product variety, plus labor shortages due to a decline in the birth rate.
The International Federation of Robotics estimates that by 2022, 4 million industrial robots will be working in factories worldwide. Mahatma Gandhi's iconic pair of gold-plated glasses went up for auction last weekend. East Bristol Auctions in Southwest England received the glass in their mailbox with a letter attached. Andy Stowe is an auctioneer.
We came in one Monday morning to find an envelope rather haphazardly sticking out of our letterbox. A colleague of mine grabbed the envelope, we opened it up, and inside was a pair of spectacles along with a note which said, "These once belonged to Gandhi, give me a call." And we kind of went, "Okay then." And a few hours later, after lunch, I gave the phone number a call, and we came across this incredible story of these spectacles belonging to Gandhi, given to the vendor's uncle back in around about 1920 or so.
The independence hero gave the glasses to the vendor's uncle while he was working for British Petroleum in South Africa during the 1920s or 30s, said the auction house. Stowe said once the bifocals went under the hammer, the auction house instantly started to receive bets well beyond their initial appraisal.
Our initial estimate on these was actually £10,000 to £15,000 based on some previous auction results for similar items. But very quickly, bids rapidly exceeded £50,000. And as we stand a few days before the sale, it's all still to play for. These are going to sell for a lot of money.
The final sale of the glasses went for £260,000, about $340,000. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
We continue on VOA Asia. Families of victims gunned down at two New Zealand mosques urged a judge to impose the toughest possible sentence, life without parole, on the gunman during a sentencing hearing on Tuesday. Reuters' Edward Baran reports.
"Please, I want you to give this man the highest punishment if you can. I want you not to let this man see the sun.
A survivor of last year's New Zealand mosque shooting, Hazem Mohammed, demanded justice in court on Tuesday. He and other survivors were facing up to white supremacist Brenton Tarrant, a 29-year-old Australian. Kyron Goss is the nephew of victim Linda Armstrong.
She never even stood a chance. To this day, I have not received an apology, nor have I seen any shred of remorse for his despicable actions.
Tarrant is scheduled to be sentenced this week after pleading guilty to 51 murders, 41 attempted murders, and one charge of committing a terrorist act during the 2019 shooting rampage in Christchurch, which he live-streamed on Facebook. Families of victims gunned down and survivors urged the judge to impose the toughest possible sentence, life without parole, on the gunman. Tarrant showed no remorse and even appeared to smirk at one survivor during the hearing. Nathan Smith, originally from the UK, recounted how he held a three-year-old boy as he died in his arms.
When you get 3 minutes, which you'll have plenty of, funny, eh? Very funny. Maybe you should try to read the Quran. It's beautiful. I have nothing else to say to you. But you will be judged. You will be judged.
A murder conviction carries a mandatory sentence of life in prison, but the judge can also rule out parole, a measure that's never been used in New Zealand.
That was Reuters reporter Edward Baran. This is VOA Asia. Rohingya politician Abdul Rashid was born in Myanmar and is one of the very few from the Muslim minority to have Myanmar citizenship. But when the country goes to the polls in November, he will not be able to stand. Libby Hogan reports.
Aspiring politician Abdul Rashid was born in Myanmar. His father was a civil servant, but Rashid's name won't be on the ballot in November because officials accuse him of having foreign roots. And he's not alone. He's among a half dozen candidates who have been rejected, all of them Muslim Rohingya. Officials say Rashid's parents weren't citizens when he was born, despite documents that Rashid says proves his case. In Myanmar, they do not recognize the term Rohingya or the community as an indigenous ethnic group.
This is a pension letter from my father, and this is an updated ID from my mother. The election commission rejected me, even though I've submitted the form with all required documents. I don't know what the matter is, and I can't find any answer.
The citizenship cards of his parents, called National Registration Cards, were abruptly withdrawn in the 1990s and replaced with temporary white cards. And then in 2015, with a stroke of the pen, former President Thun Sein nullified the cards, stripping the Rohingya of their right to vote. Successive military governments that ruled Myanmar took away the Rohingya's identity documents, leaving many with no proof of their origins. Rashid hoped an election win for Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's party would in time see Rohingya rights recognised. But he has had his dreams crushed again.
Now this is a democratic government, and I had high hopes with Aung San Suu Kyi. The 2020 election is under her democratic government, and I'd hoped the policy would be amended and there wouldn't be any discrimination. We thought that we would be accepted as well, but that's not the case.
Of at least a dozen Rohingya candidates that have applied, six have already been rejected, all of them hoping for a chance under Suu Kyi's democratic government. Analysts say the polls on November 8th are an important test of the transition away from direct military rule. But more than 730,000 Rohingya were forced to flee from Myanmar in 2017 after a military crackdown that the UN said was carried out with genocidal intent. Rights groups say the disqualification of Rohingya candidates demonstrates the limits of reform in the country.
Reuters correspondent Libby Hogan reporting. While most parents are stressed about kids and remote online learning, some experts say expect more of that in the future. And that may be a good thing. Deanna Mitchell has more.
As many children begin the school year online, parents struggle with how to get their kids to learn through a screen. But tech CEO Nicole Lazzaro is excited. She hopes the pandemic will be a catalyst for change in technology and education.
It's this turning point in history because for my entire career, I've tried to get, more technology into the classroom, but there's been so much resistance.
Lazaro is passionate about games. She is a veteran game designer and develops games in virtual and augmented realities. She's also been hired by game companies like Electronic Arts and movie and TV studios such as LucasArts, the Cartoon Network, and Nickelodeon.
100% of the world's students are online learners right now. The use of games in that online learning environment, the use of VR, the use of AR, there's just this huge potential.
Lazaro said kids are much more likely to retain information they learn in VR, as it's an experience rather than a lecture. Of course, not all kids have computers or smartphones, let alone a VR headset. Christine Greenhow is an education professor at Michigan State University.
There's a long list of technologies like virtual reality that I think could be wonderful tools.
Lazaro agrees that there is a lot that needs to be done before VR goes mainstream.
We need to deliver the hardware at a cheap price point. We need to educate the teachers so that they can understand how to use it. And then we need to give the experiences in VR.
It's a vision that parents worried about their children's online education may come to embrace. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Oakland, California.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Republicans have officially nominated President Donald Trump as their candidate in November's national election to decide who controls the White House. The president has plans to speak at all four nights of the convention and to give his acceptance speech in Washington. Ahead of the convention, party representatives discuss their plans on Sunday morning talk shows as we hear more from VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
Republican delegates begin meeting this week in Charlotte, North Carolina, and will likely nominate President Donald Trump as their candidate to defeat former Vice President Joe Biden in November's presidential election. Trump, dealing with a troubled economy, ongoing protests over social and racial injustice, and criticism over his response to a coronavirus pandemic that has killed more than 176,000 Americans, trails Biden in most national polls. Sunday, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, however, praised his boss's work ethic in making a pitch for a second term.
This president, each and every day, is not only well-prepped, but does more than any president that I've ever been able to have the privilege of researching and reading about in terms of wanting to make sure that we advance critical agendas for the hardworking American people on Main Street.
Meanwhile, Trump's challenger Joe Biden made history last week naming Senator Kamala Harris as his vice presidential candidate. Harris is the first black woman and South Asian American on a national ticket, and deputy campaign manager Kate Benningfield says Biden is about inclusion and a promise to heal a nation battling the coronavirus pandemic.
You know, as president, Joe Biden is somebody who would be able to bring people to the table to get meaningful change done and to get relief to people who need it, to the small businesses who are hurting, to the working families who are hurting.
As many as 336 of more than 2,400 Republican delegates will be in Charlotte Monday, after which the Republican Party will move to virtual locations. Other members of the Trump family will speak this week, including First Lady Melania Trump. The president is expected to appear every night, and Thursday he will accept the party's nomination from the South Lawn of the White House, where he will deliver his acceptance speech. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. Republican delegates to the party's national convention have flown into the state of North Carolina, where because of the pandemic, there is now a scaled-down in-person convention, as well as added virtual events. Carolyn Pursuti spoke with national delegates who arrived from around the country and were eager to renominate President Donald Trump with the aim of winning a second term in the White House.
Shirlene Ostrov is stepping out cautiously. It is her first visit outside her state since the pandemic. Ostrov is the Republican chair from Hawaii, a Democratic-controlled state with severe COVID restrictions.
Our economy is decimated. We have zero tourists coming in. Restaurants aren't open. And people say this is not the vision. This is not going to be sustainable.
It's also challenging to be Republican in the traditionally liberal state of Oregon, where Portland is in its third month of Black Lives Matter protests. Bill Currier says the president did his part to try to end them.
When he offered to help with national or federal resources in Portland to calm or quell the riots and so on, and the mayor and the governor basically snubbed him, that didn't sit well with people, even non-Republicans.
Democrats argued last week that Trump's actions as president worsened both the pandemic and racial protests. National polls indicate their presidential nominee, Joe Biden, now has a 9-point lead. But among Republicans, Trump remains popular. And among Americans, his 42% approval rating is a point higher than a year ago. Kansas delegate Mike Kuckelman says he listened to Democrats during their convention and didn't hear anything new.
I saw that, and a lot of what Biden said was just they were attacks on the president. He didn't tell us anything that he was going to do or his administration would do if he were elected.
Tonight,
Biden selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. As the first black woman and first Asian American woman on a major party ticket, she is seen partly as a way to win over women voters. Ostrov, who is raising two college-aged daughters, says she doubts its effectiveness.
I'm not an identity politics person. Obviously, I'm a daughter of immigrants. I served the military. I'm a woman of color. None of that is important on why to vote for or identify with a candidate.
Democrats are also out near the convention trying to change minds, but not Tracy Honnels.
For me doing that? Absolutely not. No, I support President Trump. I've supported him since 2016, early on in 2016. I believe that he's the right person to take us forward. There's no way I would consider moving over to support Joe Biden.
Security around the convention hall is tight. The in-person events on Monday impose a limit of just 6 delegates per state and territory. And it doesn't end here. The 336 delegates are invited to the White House on Thursday to watch President Trump accept his party's nomination in person. Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
We're glad to have you with us for VOA Asia Weekend. During his first term as president, Donald Trump met 3 times and reportedly exchanged at least 25 personal letters with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But those interactions could soon end, depending on the outcome of the November presidential election, as we hear from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
Donald Trump may have redefined what is possible with North Korea, but his challenger, Joe Biden, has promised a more traditional approach to U.S. foes.
I'll be a president who will stand with our allies and friends and make it clear to our adversaries the days of cozying up to dictators is over.
Biden says he wouldn't meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un without preconditions. His running mate, Kamala Harris, said she wouldn't exchange love letters with Kim either. Any talks, if they happen at all, would probably be working-level discussions rather than big summits. Instead, Biden says he would work with allies to pressure North Korea. To analyst Bong Young-shik, that policy sounds like a throwback to that of former U.S. President Barack Obama.
It's going to be very similar to Obama administration's North Korea policy, dubbed as a policy of strategic patience, basically just waiting for North Korea to get smoke out of the hole, out of the desperation.
But after conducting years of tests, North Korea now has a credible nuclear weapons program, and many believe the calculation has changed.
Korea has nuclear weapons and ICBMs that can possibly carry nuclear warheads to at least part of U.S. Territory or U.S. bases in East Asia. So now you can be strategically patient in terms of engaging in actual nuclear deterrence with North Korea, right? All you need to do is prevent North Korean leadership from pushing the button to fire the missiles.
Trump has had some success. Since the summits began, North Korea has refrained from any big missile or nuclear tests. But for months, North Korea has refused to talk. Trump insists the deadlock will be broken as soon as he's reelected. But Trump is likely to be unpredictable, says analyst Soo Kim of the RAND Corporation.
The principles that he sort of follows does not really seem to be pegged to anything in particular. So whatever whims or mood he feels, he's able to just to backtrack or do a complete 180 from where he was.
For the U.S. and North Korea, it's a wide range of possibilities. There could be more summits. maybe a return to fire and fury threats, or just the same old deadlock that's been there for years. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. A sentencing hearing has begun for the Australian man who carried out the mosque attacks in the New Zealand city of Christchurch in March 2019. Brenton Tarrant has admitted killing 51 worshippers and injuring dozens more. In court Monday, the self-confessed white supremacist has come face-to-face with relatives of some of his victims. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A year after his deadly rampage, Brenton Tarrant pleaded guilty to the murders of 51 Muslim worshippers, 40 charges of attempted murder and a terrorism offence. The 29-year-old Australian man had earlier denied attacking two mosques during Friday prayers in Christchurch, New Zealand, before reversing his plea. A sentencing hearing began Monday and is expected to last 4 days. Tarrant faces a minimum prison term of 17 years, but Justice Cameron Mander, the High Court judge in charge of the case, has the authority to order him locked away for life with no parole, a sentence that has never been handed down in New Zealand. More than 60 people will deliver victim impact statements to the court. Some have travelled from overseas and undergone a mandatory 2-week COVID-19 quarantine in order to take part. Among the victims was 35-year-old Hussein Alomari. His sister Aya says she wants to look his killer in the eye and tell him her spirit has not been crushed.
My plan is to eyeball him. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to tell him what he intended to do has done the complete opposite effect. Okay, you've killed my brother, but God is still there. So, I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
Brenton Tarrant's crime sent waves of grief around the world. Many of his victims were migrants and refugees from India, Somalia, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. The youngest to die was a 3-year-old boy. The attacks horrified New Zealand, an isolated country of 5 million. Its people invariably saw their country as a safe place, far from the extremist violence that scarred other parts of the world. That changed in March 2019. The Friday prayer murders in Christchurch prompted the New Zealand government to ban the military-style semi-automatic weapons that were used by the gunmen. He live-streamed part of his rampage, adding to the trauma of his victims' families. This week, they can tell their stories of pain, loss and survival at the High Court in Christchurch. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, some elderly Americans who normally volunteer to work at election polling stations say they will be staying at home this year because of the risk of contracting COVID-19. The elderly are the most vulnerable to the coronavirus, and this is likely to have an effect on the November elections, not just for turnout, but also at the polling stations themselves, because those locations depend on volunteer workers. We have more in this report by Valentina Vasileva, narrated by Anna Rice.
65-year-old Elizabeth Slanta from Arlington, Virginia, has been volunteering at polling stations for the past 3 decades. It's been a Slanta family tradition. Her mother has also helped out at the polls. Retired in 2011, Slanta was looking forward to volunteering again in November until she tested positive for COVID-19 in March.
I came up with the virus, coronavirus, on the 14th of March. And the only real contact that I could think of that I really had a lot of contact with people was at the polls, because I worked at my precinct near where I live.
The virus hit Slanta hard. For 3 long weeks, she was at home fighting a high fever, and she's still suffering from the virus's effects. She has not regained her sense of smell and has lost some of her hair. Recently, she decided that until the pandemic is over, she's not going to volunteer at the polls.
The chief in my precinct, his wife, I think, might be somehow immune compromised. And then also his mother-in-law lives with them now. So I emailed him for the last election and I said, I am not going to be working, so don't count on me. And he said, I think I am not going to work either because, you know, of the situation.
When Slanta worked at the polls for primary elections in March, there were no strict protective measures in place yet. Face masks in indoor public spaces were not mandatory, and social distancing wasn't taken seriously either. But the situation has changed, says another poll worker, Emily Landsman, who plans to volunteer in November.
The county provided us with masks, and they say Arlington elections, so they're kind of fun as far as masks go. They offered us face shields if we wanted that. They put up plexiglass barriers, so there's a barrier between the voter and us.
Still, Landsman says she's a little worried. She's volunteering at the largest polling station in Arlington County, where over 6,000 people are registered. But she's determined to go through with it. After all, she adds, someone does have to work. According to the data of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, in 2018, some 58% of election workers were over 60. That is the age group that is most at risk during the coronavirus pandemic. If local election officials don't manage to find enough younger volunteers, the 2020 November elections might be tricky, says Ryan Pieranunzi of the Fair Elections Center.
So in 2016, according to the EAC, the Election Assistance Commission, it took over 900,000 poll workers to hold the election across the country in 2016, and a significant portion of those were over the age of 60. So we know that it's going to be hundreds of thousands of people who are older Americans over the age of 60 who traditionally who have served in the past, and we're not sure, you know, what proportion of those will be serving this year versus not.
Staffing companies are reaching out to college students to work, but experts say it is not that easy to convince young Americans. Poll work usually requires 12 hours a day with lots of responsibility and also stress. Staffing polling centers does pay. The compensation varies from state to state and can range from $14 to $15 an hour. This might motivate some young unemployed students, recruiters believe. The question is whether there will be enough volunteers to staff the polling centers in November. For Valentina Vasilieva in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Spaceflight has long captured the imagination of people around the world, and young people here in the United States have had the chance to go to the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama, which is home to Space Camp, where they could learn how to become an astronaut. But Space Camp faced permanent closure as COVID-19 forced the internationally popular Science and Technology Center to turn students and visitors away. Then, a change. VOA's Kane Faribault reports an online campaign to save Space Camp is providing a lifeline to get through the pandemic.
2019, the 50th anniversary of astronauts landing on the moon. It's a banner year for the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Visitors from around the world came to celebrate the city where the Saturn V rocket that carried astronauts into space was developed.
We had record number of attendance. We had almost 45,000 students in Space Camp last year in 2019. We were starting off 2020 so strong. Our attendance was higher just even in the museum, and we were heading into a sold-out summer of Space Camp.
Pat Ammons with the U.S. Space and Rocket Center says it came to a halt when COVID-19 arrived in the U.S. Space Camp, the popular program the center operates where youth learn how to be astronauts, closed completely in March. 2 months of revenue from campers and visitors to the museum evaporated instantly. Although a state agency, Ammons says the center doesn't get state or federal funding and didn't qualify for benefits in the multi-trillion dollar coronavirus relief package passed by Congress earlier this year.
We earn our income through the people who walk in the door and the students who attend our Space Camp program,
which includes many international visitors.
About 20% yearly of our students come from overseas. In the fall particularly, we have a lot of students who come from Australia, the UK, China, India, a lot of students who come as part of school groups. And so those students, of course, won't be coming this year.
As attendance tanked, the center was quickly burning through savings.
By the end of October, we would have exhausted all the remaining cash that we had.
If we do not receive a minimum of $1.5 million by the end of October, we were not going to be able to keep the museum open, and we were not going to be able to offer Space Camp in 2021.
Ben Chandler, a Space Camp graduate and now chairman of the nonprofit U.S. Space and Rocket Center Education Foundation, which helps fund the center and Space Camp, says that's when it was decided to ask for help through an online GoFundMe campaign.
Inside of 7 days, we've raised over $1.5 million through, I think at last I had looked, there had been 8,000 individuals that had donated to the campaign.
Boeing Corporation and SAIC were two of the biggest donors, together contributing $750,000.
Thank you for saving Space Camp.
Chandler says while the organization is somewhat transitioning from survive to thrive mode, the fundraising effort isn't over.
We're trying to repair some of that financial damage, and that's why we're going to keep the campaign open and alive and to try to do as much good while we can.
Today, while Space Camp is open, operations are significantly reduced.
We would be typically crawling with over 1,000 children a week here. We are operating at about 40 to 50% of our normal capacity in the museum, and we're only at 20% of our students in Space Camp.
Ammons says Space Camp won't stay open year-round this year due to health restrictions.
Our fall and winter season is international students and school groups. And so obviously international students and school groups aren't going to be coming to Space Camp this fall and winter.
But the hope is that progress in reducing the spread of COVID-19 will allow the Space and Rocket Center to welcome more visitors and more space campers when the facility prepares to blast off for a new, more normal season in 2021. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. More and more COVID vaccines are entering phase 3 of clinical trials. Several Chinese pharmaceuticals are among those developing vaccines, and Indonesia has decided to partner with them. But researchers in Indonesia are also looking to develop their own homegrown vaccine. VOA's Rendy Wixana looks at the efforts to test vaccines in the province of West Java and the capital, Jakarta.
Indonesia is starting phase 3 of a clinical trial for a COVID-19 vaccine in Bandung, in the province of West Java. The long-awaited vaccine is being developed in cooperation with Sinovac, a biopharmaceutical company from China. Trials with Sinovac are also being rolled out in Brazil, Bangladesh and the UAE. Indonesia is testing the vaccine on more than 1,600 volunteers, among them West Java Governor Ridwan Kamil, who volunteered himself. Medical researchers from a local university, Universitas Pajajaran, handle the lab work.
We will monitor them for 6 months and see if the vaccine works effectively. Volunteers are vaccinated twice. Then, we will schedule a monthly phone supervision. However, volunteers are able to reach our team at all times when they feel unwell.
Volunteers must be local residents of Bandung, aged between 18 to 59 years old, with no history of chronic disease. They are also asked to stay in the area for the next 6 months. Volunteers receive free health insurance coverage and a free swab test, but no compensations. The goal is to complete phase 3 by January and produce the vaccine by March 2021. Indonesian pharmaceutical company Bio Farma will handle the productions.
To start, we are preparing 100 million doses of vaccine. Hopefully, by 2021, we can increase our production capacity to 250 million doses per year.
Indonesia is the world's fourth most populous nation, with 260 million people. Medical experts say they will need at least 350 million doses of the vaccine produced by Indonesia. For that reason, they are also working to produce their own vaccine.
Because imported vaccine cannot necessarily provide us 350 million doses of vaccine directly, since they also need to supply other countries, both for commercial or aid purpose. The key to successful vaccination is sustainability. That is the most important.
To achieve that sustainability, a Jakarta-based biomolecular lab is developing their own seed vaccine using samples from the local virus outbreak. The hope is that Indonesia could be producing its own vaccine by early 2022. From Jakarta, Indonesia, Randy Wicaksana, VOA News.
Indigenous rappers have been brought in to help protect some of Australia's most vulnerable people from COVID-19. Throughout the pandemic, there has been a concerted effort to protect remote Aboriginal communities from the coronavirus. They already have high rates of heart, liver, and respiratory diseases, as well as diabetes and cancer. But 80% of Indigenous Australians live in towns and cities, and measures to prevent the spread of infection have been boosted by a new awareness campaign. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
The song is called 1.5. It's about safe social distancing at 1.5 metres, and it's a message for Australia's urban Aboriginal communities. It's co-written by Mikesha Masala, a young Indigenous singer from Sydney.
Also, it was about creating a song that would encourage community to continue to stay COVID safe and to also bring a little bit of fun and pride back into isolation.
Melbourne remains under a strict lockdown after a sharp rise in COVID-19 cases. The situation in Australia's second biggest city is gradually improving, and so far, Indigenous groups have avoided large numbers of infections. Caroline Kell, an Aboriginal health official, says communities have worked hard to keep safe.
We're not seeing a great amount of transmission in and between families, unlike the broader population. So that means that people are self-isolating and quarantining effectively and stopping the spread in between families, which is a really positive thing, considering a lot of our community do live in pretty overcrowded and sort of transient accommodation.
Coronavirus has certainly changed the way we live, work, and connect. These changes can be hard for some of us and can make us feel no good in our head or spirit, like sad or worried all the time.
Some of us might. Public health campaigns are also helping Indigenous Australians in remote settlements who already suffer high rates of chronic disease in areas with limited medical facilities cope with the mental stress of the pandemic. A recent study by the University of Western Australia found the coronavirus had put many First Nation people at risk of severe psychological distress. Australia's Indigenous peoples make up about 3% of the national population. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We're glad to have you with us for VOA Asia Weekend. The effect of the new national security law that China imposed on Hong Kong is apparently extending far beyond the territory, all the way to U.S. college campuses. Classes at some elite universities will carry a warning label this fall. This course may cover material considered politically sensitive by China. And schools are weighing measures to try to shield students and faculty from prosecution by Chinese authorities. The issue has become especially pressing because at least the first semester at many universities will be taught online, and that means some students from China and Hong Kong will connect with their U.S. classmates via video links. Some academics fear the classes could be recorded and ultimately end up in the hands of Chinese authorities. Almost 370,000 Chinese students and roughly 7,000 from Hong Kong enrolled at U.S. universities in the 2018-2019 school year, and academics in the United States say they often opt to take classes on Chinese law, culture, and politics because they want to understand more about their country and how the world views it. Christopher Balding, an associate professor at the Fulbright University, tells VOA's Adriana Zhang most U.S. colleges and universities have not addressed several serious issues concerning China and its visiting students.
I understand where universities are coming from and that they are trying to act in the best interest of the student to keep the student safe. I think the bigger problem is that what this indicates is that universities are yielding to Chinese pressure and the very reasonable concern that they have over student safety. However, universities have absolutely no track record of speaking out about China. They have no track record about how they have sought to address historical concerns about Chinese behavior. And they appear intent on engaging in a series of practices such as accepting Chinese money and hiding it in violation of U.S. law, as well as other practices such as arguing against reasonable visa restrictions against PLA graduate students in science programs in the United States.
Would the students miss out on learning critical knowledge or skills? And would this also hurt the quality of education in the United States?
Yes, I think it is very troubling that that they would, for instance, place warning labels on classes that Beijing might consider sensitive. That is indicative of a creeping censorship by Beijing, even if it's not explicit, even if it is not mandated by law. It is very clearly indicative of the influence that Beijing censorship is having in the United States. So I do think it weakens a student's historical and in-depth knowledge of China if they're going to be allowed to opt out of things or be given warning labels on those types of events.
You did mention that the universities are doing that to protect students. And we also saw some cases that where like Chinese nationals have been arrested or even sentenced to prison for what they did here in the United States. So what do you think about that?
Again, this is part of that larger pattern of behavior by universities that we've seen. Whether it's professors, American and Chinese, engaging in behavior such as not reporting of income or failing to disclose ties to Chinese universities or sharing unauthorized data, whether it is forms of, you know, economic espionage or coordinating their activities with Chinese consulates or the embassy. I think the bigger problem for universities is that pattern of behavior of turning a blind eye and pretending that those types of behaviors.
Christopher Balding, associate professor at the Fulbright University, speaking with VOA's Adriana Zhang.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. If you live in India or part of a family that has immigrated from there, you could very well be excited for the first woman of color on a majority party's ticket in U.S. politics. Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris is expected to galvanize the minority vote. But Harris also faces some unique challenges and opportunities as she campaigns alongside presidential nominee Joe Biden. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Sawara has this story from Wilmington, Delaware, where Harris last week accepted her party's nomination.
A historic moment in U.S. history as Kamala Harris, the first American of Jamaican and Indian descent, accepts the Democratic Party's nomination to become Joe Biden's running mate.
We're all in this fight. You, me, and Joe, together. What an awesome responsibility. What an awesome privilege.
Her call hits the right note with many Democratic voters.
I think a lot of young people across the country are actually applauding and feeling connected to her.
There have been two female vice presidential candidates before Harris, Democrat Geraldine Ferraro in 1984 and Republican Sarah Palin in 2008. Ferraro and Palin were selected to energize campaigns that were trailing in the polls, but Harris is joining Biden at a time when polls show him the front runner.
And so Biden is playing from real strengths and nonetheless saw fit not to shake up the race, but to kind of consolidate those advantages that he has by bringing on a woman and a woman of color. And that speaks, I think, volumes about the direction of the Democratic Party and where our country is going.
Women in American politics have long encountered additional challenges compared to their male peers, including being judged by their appearance or even their voice.
But the president's senior advisor, Jenna Ellis, just said Kamala Harris sounds like me.
And as a female candidate of color, Harris has faced extra scrutiny over her family background. Although Harris is an American citizen born in California, President Trump has not rejected false claims that Harris is ineligible because of her parents' immigration status. Ultimately, it's the voters who will decide what to believe.
As somebody with immigrant parents, you know, I don't have to prove I'm American to somebody again and again and again and again. You know, the racists are never going to believe you.
Harris, a former prosecutor, will play a key role in delivering the Democrats' most pointed attacks on the incumbent administration. Already, President Trump has called her mean and nasty, remarks some consider sexist. Still, Harris has a huge opportunity to be the future of her party.
If elected, Biden will be 78 when he's inaugurated in January, making him the oldest person to ever assume the American presidency. Biden has spoken of himself as a transitional figure and has suggested he may not seek a second term.
The Democratic National Convention showcased the racial and cultural diversity of their political coalition, as well as a generational gulf in the party, something that Biden is trying to address with his 55-year-old VP pick.
You know, he's signaling his interest in handing the baton off to Harris and people who look like Harris and people who have similar outlooks as Harris and have her kind of life experience.
Which means whether or not Joe Biden wins in 2020, Kamala Harris will likely look ahead to 2024. From Wilmington, Delaware, Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, the coronavirus pandemic is driving many Americans to consider voting by mail in this November's presidential election, instead of casting their ballots in public polling places. But just as the Postal Service faces a major test of its election year capabilities, congressional Democrats say the Trump administration's recent changes at the U.S. Postal Service could lead to voter suppression. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson explains the controversy.
An unprecedented level of election year mail. That's the expectation as millions of Americans resort to mailing in their ballots in this upcoming presidential election to avoid the coronavirus infection. But congressional Democrats are warning the system may not be able to keep up.
If you want to vote in person, you can. We also want to make sure if you want to vote by mail, you can. And if the mail is late, your ballot may not be counted.
This concern was raised after Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a Republican Party fundraiser who took the position earlier this summer, announced major operational changes, including the removal of some blue collection boxes, shutting down some mail sorting equipment, and changes to post office hours and employee overtime. The president is supporting those changes.
The post office is running as well as it has in a long time.
Trump's previous criticism of mail-in voting led Democrats to say DeJoy's changes were deliberate to discourage voting by mail.
Anybody knows that it is unlawful to interfere with the post office in order to try to cook and fix and disrupt a United States election, which is what this Postmaster General was doing on the orders of Donald Trump, who told the country on national TV and via Twitter that he's interfering with the post office because he doesn't like mail-in ballots.
Democratic attorneys general in at least 20 U.S. states have said they would sue the post office for the resulting delay. In response, DeJoy announced this week he would not implement those planned changes until after the election, defending them by saying they were long planned before he assumed the post. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi still plans to hold an emergency session of the U.S. House to vote on more funding for the post office to handle the influx of ballots.
I don't frankly trust the Postmaster General in what he said, and if he is sincere about it, it means the bully has backed off.
DeJoy will also face questioning from two congressional panels this coming week, as Democrats say some of the changes may be too late to reverse, with Election Day just a little over 2 months away. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
A man-made mega constellation orbiting Earth has grown again after another history-making commercial launch. Satellite images document a quarter century of melting ice on Earth, plus images of our home planet from space and of space from our home planet. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. And liftoff for the Falcon 9. Good Starlink.
From Florida's Cape Canaveral, the commercial spaceflight company SpaceX launched another batch of its Starlink satellites into space. The launch marked the second Starlink mission this month and SpaceX's 14th mission so far this year. Also on board were three Earth observation satellites called SkySats. SpaceX says the Falcon 9 booster that carried the satellites set a record Tuesday, becoming the first rocket to complete six flights. The company says its Starlink network will provide high-speed broadband internet to underserved parts of the world. Also this week, scientists in the United States said they analyzed 25 years' worth of satellite data to look deep beneath the surface of Antarctica's melting ice shelves. PhD student Sushil Adesumilli studies at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego.
So usually, if you're trying to look at changes in the ocean, you take a ship there. But in Antarctica, because the ocean's under thousands of feet of ice, you have to use satellite data.
Adesumilli credits European Space Agency satellites for a quarter century's worth of measurements taken from the ice sheets in Antarctica. Radar altimeter satellites make it possible for researchers to study the data.
What they have is a radar ping, and it's a very short burst of energy. And that goes down from the satellite, which is orbiting around 500 miles above the Earth, hits the ice and comes back up. So what we do is we measure the time that the radar signal takes to hit the ice and come back up.
The faster those pings bounce back to space, the thicker the ice. NASA funded the study, which estimates the continent's ice shelves lost nearly 4,000 gigatons since 1994, producing an amount of meltwater that could almost fill the Grand Canyon. NASA astronaut Chris Cassidy captured these still images of Hurricane Genevieve from the International Space Station. The National Hurricane Center warns Genevieve could cause life-threatening flash floods and mudslides across Southern California. And finally, Russian cosmonaut Ivan Vagner captured this time-lapse of Antarctic aurora or the Southern Lights. Vagner says he also saw five objects that, at the time of this report, remain unidentified. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.